Today is Tuesday, July 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Amnesty International is looking into the actions of federal officers in Portland as they continue to clash with demonstrators.
The mandates around use of force and what is excessive and what isn't, and the fact that excessive use of force is unlawful, that is the important thing.
Plus, it took nearly 5 days, but the EU has a budget.
This is a good deal, this is a strong deal, and most importantly, this is the right deal for Europe.
And SpaceX sets a record. We'll have those stories and more next. Demonstrators crowded in front of the U.S. Federal Courthouse and Portland's Justice Center late Monday night before authorities cleared them out. Numerous explosions could be heard and smoke could be seen rising from the area. Protests have filled the streets of the northwestern U.S. city of Portland, Oregon for 52 days following the death of George Floyd while in police custody. The Trump administration dispatched officers from federal agencies against the wishes of state and local officials there. And on Monday, congressional Democrats condemned the Trump administration, calling for an immediate investigation into the use of federal law enforcement officers to arrest peaceful protesters. But U.S. President Donald Trump defended the practice, saying that some U.S. cities have lost control of the protests. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson takes things from here.
In Portland over the weekend, escalating tensions. Protesters massed around police buildings, some committing vandalism and briefly setting a police building on fire. Before everyone fled the area amid warnings from law enforcement. That civil unrest coming as congressional Democrats demand answers on reports peaceful protesters in Portland are being arrested by unidentified federal authorities. President Trump defended that federal intervention Monday.
We have more federal law enforcement, that I can tell you. In Portland, they've done a fantastic job.
But local authorities say they don't need federal help.
Your presence here isn't wanted. It's not needed.
Federal assistance is making mostly peaceful protests worse, according to the state's governor.
It's like pouring gasoline on a fire.
A group of self-described mothers formed a human wall Sunday to protect protesters from federal tactical units. And Democratic Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib vowed on Twitter she would protect her own city of Detroit after Trump said federal authorities may be needed to address rising violence in other U.S. cities.
Put down your need for violence.
Local religious leaders are planning a peace march to try to calm tensions, even as the state of Oregon sues multiple federal agencies for what it says was the illegal detention of U.S. citizens. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
Oregon's attorney general is suing the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. And VOA's Jason Patinkin spoke to Amnesty International researcher Brian Kastner in Buffalo, New York, about what's taking place as U.S. President Donald Trump contemplated sending federal agents to other cities.
We're watching a few things in Portland. One is arbitrary arrest and arbitrary detention from federal officers that pull up to a crowd and put people in a van and take them away. Second one is the use of these less lethal weapons, how they're using tear gas, how they're using pepper spray, how quickly that they use those two. And then also the use of kinetic impact projectiles, as they're often called, these 40 millimeter rounds. The one case where a person was really significantly injured, he was standing in the street. He had his hands up. He was holding a speaker above his head when he was shot in the face. And if you're shot in the face or head, it can kill you. It can cause life-changing injuries. The third thing that we're watching that we've seen very recently is some medics being picked up and beaten and harassed. And these people are, you know, identified by red crosses on their backpacks or on their shirts. They're volunteers. They're not part of any particular organization, but you see them in protests around the world, people who show up and just want to help whoever happens to be injured. And we've seen some videos now of of these medics, you know, just being harassed, beaten, chased away from the protest areas by camouflaged officers that we assume are federal, but hard to know when they're not identifying themselves and not marked.
Looking specifically at these arrests by camouflaged men, what was your initial reaction to seeing those videos?
My initial reaction would be that in another context, they look like disappearances or kidnappings. And in Oregon, I mean, there is a history of far right groups dressing up in body armor and camouflage and carrying many of the same weapons. And so I think when protesters are saying that, you know, people dressed and armed a certain way come and get them, and they're not read their rights in the United States. They have Miranda rights, they're called, that police need to identify themselves and say why they're under arrest. And so when people are simply picked up, I think it's reasonable to ask, well, who is the group picking me up? And it's taken a few days for journalists to be able to figure out who some of these organizations are.
Now, these federal agents who Trump has deployed are supposedly there to protect a federal courthouse, which has been vandalized by protesters. Is that justification for the use of force that we've seen from these federal agents?
So no matter what their mandate is from the federal government and what they're supposed to protect or how far out from a building their jurisdiction goes, none of that to me is as important as the fact that the mandates around use of force and what is excessive and what isn't, and the fact that excessive use of force is unlawful, that is the important thing. So whether they're inside a federal building, outside of a federal building, those use of force guidelines apply no matter what. And putting graffiti on a wall is not justification for use of force, for, you know, for shooting somebody in the head with a less lethal 40 millimeter round. The fact that it's past curfew is not a justification for shutting down a protest and calling it a riot. It's not like your human right to freedom of assembly or your human right to protest goes away because of some paint on a wall or because a certain hour on the clock was hit.
Last of all, the authorities in Portland and the authorities in Oregon have told the federal forces to leave. They've demanded that the Department of Homeland Security and the Trump administration pull these federal agents out of Portland and out of Oregon. But the Trump administration and the Department of Homeland Security have refused. What do you make of this?
Yeah, that's very worrying. And I would say in other contexts or in other countries and other parts of the world, when local security forces potentially are getting ready to clash with federal security forces, that's when really social order can break down and there can be a really big problem. So in other countries, you know, this would cause us grave concern. It causes us the same concern in the United States. And if we're in a position where the Oregon National Guard feels in conflict with the Border Patrol or other federal agents, that is just a real recipe for trouble. And you know, we would urge, you know, the government to sort itself out and not put any of the security forces or more importantly, the citizens on the street to be put in the position between these groups.
Brian Kastner is a researcher with the human rights group Amnesty International. He was speaking to VOA's Jason Patinkin. With over 14.7 million confirmed novel coronavirus cases and nearly 610,000 fatalities, researchers are reporting progress in the race to develop a safe and effective vaccine against the disease. Two different experimental vaccines have produced strong immune responses in late-stage human trials, and that's according to peer-reviewed studies published in Monday's British medical journal, The Lancet. One is being developed by a joint venture between Britain's Oxford University and the British-Swedish drug maker AstraZeneca, the other by the Chinese biotech firm CanSino Biologics. Additionally, U.S. drug maker Pfizer and its German partner BioNTech also reported progress on their vaccine candidate. The vaccine developed by the joint Oxford-AstraZeneca partnership is receiving the most attention, with the company signing agreements with many governments to supply its vaccine if it is proved to be effective and granted regulatory approval. The company has already committed to making 2 billion doses. President Trump is also set again to take center stage in the U.S. federal government's coronavirus response. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani explains.
They used to happen nearly every day.
We're making tremendous strides against this invisible enemy.
The president in the White House briefing room. That ended in late April.
The disinfectant, we've knocked it out
in a minute.
When he suggested injecting disinfectant could help treat the virus. For months, aides have urged him to essentially ignore the virus and instead focus on other issues that could help politically. But with the president trailing Joe Biden in the polls, he'll be back.
I think it's a great way to get information out to the public.
The U.S. still has the most confirmed cases and deaths in the world, and infections continue soaring in parts of a nation on edge after months of the pandemic. The president insists nobody wants to talk about the good news.
You know, we're doing very well in so many different ways.
Saying a lot of the country is doing well. He wants to use the briefings to highlight progress on vaccines and therapeutics. And with the election looming, he's hoping they can boost his flagging poll numbers. The virus has largely stalled his signature campaign rallies, and aides say this is one way he can reach voters. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Officials in Canada and the United States have agreed to keep the vast border between the two countries closed for at least another month. As Craig McCulloch reports from Vancouver, two recent surveys of Canadians indicate they overwhelmingly want the border to remain closed because of record high numbers of coronavirus infections in the U.S.
In making the announcement, officials in both Washington and Ottawa agreed to keep the 8,893-kilometer-long border closed to all but commercial and essential traffic. This means only commercial goods and people, such as nurses and doctors, who live in one country and work in the other, can cross. Travel for tourism or activities like retail shopping are banned. Started on March 20th, the closure is supported by two separate opinion polls taken this month that found more than 80% of Canadians want the border to remain closed to non-essential traffic. David Webb is owner of the Ocean Rose Bed and Breakfast in White Rock, British Columbia. The Vancouver suburb sits right on the international boundary. Webb can literally see the Peace Arch border crossing and the American border town of Blaine, Washington from his home. 40% of his business is from the United States, but he agrees the border should remain closed.
I agree with that. And one of the things that we have to think about is the people who have compromised immune systems. Both my wife and I have compromised immune systems, as do many other people, and it only takes one person with the virus to cause illness with many, and I think that's what people are looking at here.
One of the polls, done by Nanos Research for the Globe and Mail newspaper, found only 3% of respondents think the border should open immediately. Nick Nanos, chief data scientist at Nanos Research, finds the results remarkable, considering how reliant Canada is on access to the United States.
It suggests that people who want to open the border immediately are less than a fringe of the population, basically less than one out of every 20. And we don't usually see this type of consensus in the polling data where, you know, upwards of eight out of every 10 agree to such what I would consider a drastic action, which is to close the border to non-essential visitors. So it's very unusual, but it speaks to the time and the threat that Canadians feel.
Differences in coronavirus infection rates are stark along the westernmost portion of the border. Washington State reported its highest level ever of infections at 1,267 cases and 6 deaths on July 16th. On that same day, the Canadian province of British Columbia had 21 new cases and 0 fatalities. Nearly 6% of those tested in Washington State were positive, compared to only 0.5% in British Columbia. Besides being the longest undefended international boundary in the world, the Canada-U.S. border also sees a considerable amount of business. The U.S. Trade Representative estimates that $718.5 billion in all types of trade crossed the border in 2018. That works out to just around $2 billion a day. Craig McCulloch for VOA News, Vancouver.
VOA has expanded global coverage of the pandemic on our website. And coming up later...
3, 2, 1, 0. Ignition. Liftoff.
This is VOA News.
AP Showbiz Minute. Amber Heard has accused ex-husband Johnny Depp of abusing her both physically and verbally, and said at various times during their tempestuous relationship she feared for her life.
On the first day of her testimony at the High Court in London on Monday in Depp's libel trial against the Sun newspaper over an article that labelled him a wife-beater, Heard also denied accusations she was a heavy drug taker and drinker, as well as being controlling and abusive herself. Christopher Nolan's Tenet, which had hoped to herald Hollywood's return to big theatrical releases, has been postponed again due to the ongoing coronavirus pandemic. Warner Bros. Said Monday that Tenet won't make its August 12th release date, and the studio didn't announce a new target for the release of Nolan's much-anticipated $200 million thriller. Nicki Minaj has a new release coming soon, her first child. The rapper took to Instagram on Monday to announce she's pregnant, posting photos of herself with a baby bump. One caption simply read, hashtag preggers. This is Lizzie Knight with AP Showbiz Minute.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. After four long days of negotiations, the 27-member European Union came to an agreement on an $859 billion post-pandemic fund and a $1.2 trillion budget. European Council President Charles Michel said the deal showed collective responsibility and solidarity.
This is a good deal, this is a strong deal, and most importantly, this is the right deal for Europe right now. I would like to thank all the leaders and the President of the Commission and their teams for their hard work.
To get the specifics on the deal and how the bloc overcame its previous impasse, I spoke with journalist Catherine Field in Paris, France.
The 27 leaders have agreed to set up a 750 billion euro fund, which will be handed out to member states which are struggling with the economic fallout of the coronavirus pandemic. Of that, 390 billion euros will be given in grants and 360 billion in cheap loans. Spain and Italy, whose economies have been the hardest hit, will be the main beneficiaries. However, to unlock the aid, member governments will need to submit plans showing the funds will be used to strengthen economic growth, job creation, and social resilience. And then it will go to plans to make greener and more digital economies. But these plans, and here's the crux, these plans need to be linked to economic damage caused by the coronavirus pandemic, not pre-pandemic economic ailments. So these funds will be handed out over 2 years starting from 2021. There will be strings attached, and the rules and the oversight that came with the package is what helped break the lockjam. There'll be milestones and targets, and if the EU suspects targets are not met, then member states can raise objections and there can be a block on payments, particularly payments to a country which isn't respecting the rule of law. On top of that, there was some tinkering with the overall EU budget, which allowed for some member states who initially opposed the handouts to contribute less to the EU than in previous years.
So, Catherine, I mean, we're talking huge sums of money here, $1.2 trillion for the budget, $859 billion for the post-pandemic fund. Where's the money coming from?
The European Commission, that is the executive branch of the European Union, will borrow the 750 billion euros on capital markets. It will use its AAA debt rating to raise the funds, and it will be paid back over 30 years starting in 2028. Let's not forget, this is an unprecedented level of debt, and at this stage, some of the proposals for funding the repayments could come through policies linked to tackling climate change that would include a tax on non-recycled plastics and a tax on goods imported into the EU from countries with lower carbon emissions than the EU itself.
So where does the European Union go from here? And I guess the other question that I have is, you know, what does this really mean for French President Emmanuel Macron, since this is a huge policy achievement for him?
At the outbreak of the coronavirus pandemic, there was a lot of talk of how this could be the end of the European Union. Fears that the member nations would turn in on themselves, only worry about their own economies, their own electorates. On top of that, at the start, the European Union was very slow in organising itself to adapt to the bloc's new needs. For French President Emmanuel Macron, this is a significant foreign policy victory. Macron has been calling on the EU to become more nimble, to become more economically independent, to look at new ways of functioning, to strengthen itself. So he put this plan together with German Chancellor Angela Merkel. It is an unprecedented act of solidarity in almost seven decades of European integration. And it comes at a time when the EU was struggling itself with economic crises and its own identity, especially the reverberations of Britain's departure from the bloc.
Catherine Field is a reporter living and working in Paris. SpaceX launched South Korean communications satellite Anisys 2 aboard the Falcon 9 booster that lifted astronauts Doug Hurley and Bob Benekin on their mission to the International Space Station. Reuters reporter Gloria So has the details.
3, 2, 1.
The SpaceX Falcon 9 booster lifted off to the skies Monday evening, marking another milestone journey for space travel. It sets a new record for the fastest turnaround time for reusing a rocket, one of SpaceX's commercial goals. Just 2 months ago, the Falcon 9 carried two NASA astronauts on a historic journey to the International Space Station. That marked the first time commercially developed space vehicles, owned and operated by a private entity rather than NASA, carried Americans into orbit. Now its latest mission, to launch a hefty South Korean satellite into orbit. Taking off at 5:30 p.m. local time from Cape Canaveral, Florida, the Anisys 2 rode into orbit aboard the Falcon 9. After separation, the Falcon 9 successfully landed shortly after on a drone ship stationed in the Atlantic Ocean. The satellite it helped launch will serve South Korean military needs, and its deployment was not shown in the live video.
Gloria So reports for Reuters News, and you've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser on your phone, your tablet, or computer to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This month marks the 25th anniversary of the establishment of diplomatic relations between the United States and Vietnam. It was a historic step, said Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, one that first required us to face the dark legacy of war between our two nations. In the 1980s, the U.S. and Vietnam worked to overcome the devastation of war through the repatriation of the remains of American soldiers in Vietnam. This led to better ties and the formal reestablishment of relations in 1995. Since then, said Secretary Pompeo, we've built a friendship on common interests, mutual respect, and bold resolve to overcome the past and look toward the future. The United States has contributed significantly to Vietnam's remarkable economic growth. In the past two decades, bilateral trade has grown an incredible 7,000%. Indeed, American companies are helping by pouring billions of dollars in investment into the country. Vietnam is now one of the fastest-growing economies in Southeast Asia, lifting millions out of poverty. The United States and Vietnam have also expanded people-to-people ties, including in the field of education. Nearly 30,000 young Vietnamese citizens are currently studying at universities in the United States. While in the past, the U.S. and Vietnam were opponents on the battlefield, today our security relationship is all about cooperation, said Secretary Pompeo. Recently, the USS Theodore Roosevelt visited Da Nang, the second U.S. aircraft carrier to visit Vietnam since the end of the war. And with the lifting of the U.S. arms embargo 4 years ago, the U.S. and Vietnamese militaries are looking to further increase security cooperation. Secretary Pompeo noted that there are still challenges in our relationship, but the ability to have honest discussions when we disagree is confirmation of our potential as partners. In the coming years, the United States and Vietnam must stay focused on the future, stressed Secretary Pompeo, building our cooperation in areas from cybersecurity to education to energy to defense. As we celebrate 25 years of partnership in 2020, said Secretary Pompeo, let us renew our commitment to a strong and independent Vietnam and a peaceful and prosperous Indo-Pacific region.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.